All right, Lynn, we're anxiously awaiting to hear from you.
Well, you're hearing from me now. Yesterday evening, I spent some time in Washington, D.C., at one of the Hiltons, where they have the annual White House Correspondents' Event, which has two features. One is they have a very large area in which they put all these guests together around tables. I was there at a table last year. This year I dumped it. There's a previous part which starts about 5-6 o'clock, which people come in and they have certain areas where various news agencies and so forth have their little or larger areas. I was there, made the round of a few places last year, and made the round this year without going to the dinner. So there's a big difference. Last year it was rather jovial. There were a significant number of Democrats there. There were very few this time. The place was extremely uptight. I shook hands with, Alan Greenspan, for example, and he realized who he was shaking hands with and had really almost had a nervous breakdown. There are a few other things happened there, but I can say generally what this shows is it's uptight. Now, as you probably all know by now, because it's been distributed, we're not putting the name of the senator out yet. We know who it is. Our knowledge is good, precise. But we just decided to describe the situation because it is a general situation, not just the situation of the senator. What has happened is that in the White House, around Cheney and Karl Rove and company, the argument is that I am the evil genius who is orchestrating and entirely responsible for orchestrating the problems that the White House is having in managing the Democrats, and that I am the evil genius who has reached out and has tainted some Republican senators and others. So one of these suspected Republican senators was called in and given a workover at the White House, and was told that he was a bad boy. He was working for the enemy cause. And specifically, he was my agent. And they knew that I was their problem with the Democratic Party and among Republicans, and that he was suspected of being my agent, a senator, a Democratic Republican senator. So he said, well, that's crazy. As a matter of fact, he has never spoken to me, and I've never spoken to him in this case. And he said so. He said, no, I don't believe you. You have to prove that you are not working for him. You have to go out publicly and denounce him by name to prove that you're not working for him. So the relevant senator did speak publicly, did denounce a evil influence in the Democratic Party, which was affecting the way the Democratic Party, Senate was behaving, but didn't mention my name. In the follow-up, we discovered that all over Washington, around Capitol Hill, this incident and this pattern is generally not unknown. Things like this spread rather rapidly in those circles. So we put it out that the Bush administration is clinically insane. They are saying not only that I'm an influence in the Democratic Party's conduct, especially since the 9th of November of this past year, but that I am the evil genius who is totally responsible for all this. And that there are Republicans who are working for me, that evil genius. And that's their problem. And that's what they're fighting against, is this evil genius, me. Well, that's not quite true, as you know. You have a better handle on the situation than obviously the President of the United States does. But that's the situation. And so yesterday I had a discussion with some of our people, especially with Deborah and Jeff. And after going over all the evidence, which we'd been working on for some hours, I said, go with it. But just don't put the senator's name out yet, because this is going to rattle around the country internationally and so forth, and somebody will demand that the name of the senator be mentioned. Well, it's not, there's no secret about it, because but his remarks made were public, without mentioning my name, but everyone knows who the senator is, or anyone who cares to know. So we'll identify that later. But for the time being, to frustrate some of the curiosity seekers, we'll just describe the situation, because it is not limited to this one senator. It's much more general. It indicates what our situation is. Now, as you know from what we've put out, that the president is clinically insane. And as you saw in the briefing and other reports, what he did in a press conference, and a public press conference, televised, of about an hour's duration, the man showed that he's in a case of a mental breakdown. Now, when the mental breakdown actually began, that's a debatable point. But what we saw was a man in a mental breakdown. Completely, he's a disgrace to the nation to have this fellow as president, with the name of president, with his big fat face hanging out there on the television screen, babbling away like an idiot, an ignorant idiot. And what he said, you know, for example, that number one, he said that what we do is we take in the deduction, payroll deduction, as a tax for Social Security. Now, some of the money we take in, he said, we actually spend by issuing it to what's coming to people under Social Security. But the rest of it we spend on other things. And there is no fund. There is no Social Security fund. And that pile of paper up there in Parkersburg, Virginia, is just a pile of IOUs which have no value and will never be paid. Now, those pieces of paper have to be U.S. Treasury bonds, U.S. Treasury securities. So what the President of the United States did so far, first of all, he said, we steal money from the Social Security Fund to pay for other things. Number two, we have an obligation to repay some of that money, but we're never going to pay it as a default on the U.S. securities, as a sovereign default, which means that the dollar is worth crap internationally once that thing, if that thing's in effect. Then he did something a little bit later, a minute or so later, on the question of how this is going to be arranged with the private accounts. He said, well, of course, there is a risk in investing in stock markets, so that as people become older and approaching retirement age, they're going to tend to invest in bonds rather than stock. But the president had just said a few breaths earlier, that these bonds are worthless. U.S. treasuries are worthless. And if the two U.S. treasury bonds are worthless, then the entire bond market is pretty much in a crash. This one thing, this one idea, by coming out of the mouths of this fool, would, in a sense, bring down at almost any instant the entire international monetary financial system and plunge the entire world into chaos. That's the situation. And that's what you have as a president. Now, because of this kind of thing, and you have the British press and others are referring to Bush as already a lame duck, the kind of thing I prophesied back in last November, that if certain things were done by the Democratic Party, that he would become, in effect, a lame duck. And he has become, in effect, a lame duck. And he's now being described internationally as by the British press as becoming or achieving the status of a lame duck already at this point in his second term in office. Now, look at some of the other aspects of this and get a picture of what I ran into at White House Correspondents' dinner event yesterday, the uptightness. We have this case of General Motors going bankrupt, along with Ford and some others. And the case is essentially hopeless, for the way I've described it before. Why? But it's worse than hopeless because the management of General Motors, that is the top corporate management, is worse than clinically insane. They're almost in Bush League class of insanity. They had a meeting with some people from the Senate circle, and which at meeting, which they confirmed what I had said earlier, and I had said that the way in which the management of GM had negotiated with the UAW representatives in their discussions, where there was really no negotiation, it was just a take it or leave it kind of thing, and then they broke up the meeting and they went out on their own, that this indicated that GM had no intention of maintaining significant automobile production in the United States. They were prepared, essentially, to allow it to be largely shut down and the jobs to go away. What they wanted to do was make sure, try to get rid of that pension obligation, which they have for GMAC pension obligation and so forth. And they said the same thing explicitly, according to sources in the Congress, to representatives in the Congress on their intention. They want to be bailed out. The corporation wants to be bailed out. The financial people wish to be bailed out. But they have no intention of saving the industry. They're not concerned. The industry that will produce cars internationally, we're not going to produce them anymore in the United States. There's no reason to produce cars in the United States anymore, or in general. Huh. So this is the situation we have. Now look at what that means. What that means is, I've emphasized before, that the machine tool capability of the United States as a whole now is concentrated largely in two places, principally in the automobile industry. That is, the machine tool factor in the automobile industry is the largest part of our machine tool capability. A second part, which related to that, is the aerospace capability. Now, you have a situation in which not only are airlines going into bankruptcy, but they're in a default status in bankruptcy, which means that when somebody comes along to collect on the claims, on the pension claims, on these firms which are in bankruptcy, and these firms are in default on the terms of bankruptcy, that means the government has to take it over. And what we have, therefore, is a loss. We're losing, potentially losing, our aircraft industry, which is another key component, a smaller one now today, but a key component of our national tool-making capability. Our machine tool capability is the heart of our entire physical economy. That is, our ability to produce product depends upon equipping people who work in producing things by providing them with machine tool designs, machinery, and so forth, which are necessary for this production. Without that, we're a third-world country. So what you have is you have a situation in which you have a president who is insane, as he demonstrated again on this press conference. All you have to do is see it. You see a man babbling away, and he's a national disgrace that this guy is a president, however he got there. The country is in trouble, and apparently, despite what's coming out of the Democrats and some other Republicans, there's no sanity left in government. That the control still lies with the Bush faction. They have the top control in the executive branch and the legislative branch down. The good thing is that some of the Democrats have got the act together. And so the Democratic Party leadership, as in the Senate, is a much stronger, even though less numerous, but a much stronger force than the Republicans can muster. You have Republicans who are sane, who do not like being prisoners of the Bush administration, but they have not yet come out with an open, definitive break from the control by the Bush administration. So the United States is in deep trouble. And not only that, but we are on the verge of who knows when, but soon, that any number of events could trigger a chain reaction default under which the value of the U.S. dollar would frankly collapse. It would collapse to such a degree that the collapse of the dollar in the United States and the collapse, therefore, of dollar holdings by other countries outside the United States would cause a panic beyond anything we experienced in the 1929-1933 period of the last depression. So what you have now is a tendency to deny that these problems exist, that remedies for these problems must be provided, and therefore you have a terrible uptightness. It's not a fight over two alternatives to a crisis. In one case, it's a fight over denying the reality of a crisis. On the one side, and on the Democratic side, a sense that the crisis exists, but a lack so far of clear agreement on the exact measures we're going to take to control it. So in the middle of this, it's true that I personally am in the middle of this problem. We do know what to do, and I know what to do. And I'm saying what has to be done. I'm saying more and more of it. And I'll be writing another piece now, which will be out shortly as a matter of days or a week or so, on the factor of clinical insanity as a factor determining the inability of the majority of people in leading positions in the United States, their inability to cope with and recognize the problem. There are people who do recognize we need a change in international financial architecture. They do realize we're in a depression or on the verge of it. They do recognize that something has to be done about it, but they have yet no common language of agreement on exactly what the action is we're going to have to take in the short term. That's our crisis. So then we got into a situation in this White House correspondence event yesterday in which there were very few Democrats there, some, but not like there were the year before. There was no significant discussion. There was no general camaraderie among the participants, and that usually is. They at least put on a show of being friendly and saying nice things to each other at these kinds of events. It wasn't there. There's some, of course, but minor. It was a very uptight situation. And it's the kind of uptightness you would expect when a regime is about to collapse, as on the eve of the French Revolution, when the regime is about to collapse and everybody's uptight, there is no clear vision of a workable solution for anything. But there's a determination to try to ignore both the fact of the crisis and ignore even more strenuously the idea that there might be a solution. And that's what I was in last night with a couple of people beside me who were eyewitnesses to that. That's what we'll be working on immediately in the period, days and hours ahead, that's what we're working on now, is to get a more precise indication of what this is about. Now, what we're doing otherwise, internationally, but especially in the United States, by issuing this report, which I worked up with Jeff and Deborah yesterday to release about this incident, about the senator being whammied by the White House to go after me, is to let our people get a sense of the reality of this thing. And the reason we put the report out identifying a senator by implication but not by name is to get across to our people and to our contacts the reality of the situation. That the White House, which is insane, as the president's press conference documents this, or anyone who's curious and intelligent about the matter, this kind of situation, we see me as the most important force threatening the influence of the presidency over the political processes of the United States. Now, I think that kind of information, supported by fact, is the sort of thing that our members ought to know, ought to talk about, ought to report to their friends and contacts, and ought to put out generally. You see the same thing in California. You see Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger is going down. His wife is trying to collect him, if she can find the pieces and put all the pieces together. You know, it's like Rumpelstiltskin from the famous German fairy story, who, when he was caught out by name, ripped himself apart. We're looking in California, we're seeing not a German, but an Austrian of Nazi pedigree, the governor of the state, who, in a sense, is ripping himself apart like Rumpelstiltskin. And the pieces are being scattered across the California landscape, and a few pieces falling into neighboring states. And his wife, Maria, we didn't know that Rumpelstiltskin had a wife, but Maria, the wife, is trying to collect the pieces of her tattered and torn husband and put them back together and take it home and put it down in the basement, perhaps like some Frankenstein monster scene, put the pieces back together again and revive them or something. Maybe remove the pot belly in the process. But that's where we stand. And it's important for our people to understand that that is our situation. Now, there's another aspect to this, which most of you are involved in directly or indirectly. And this is this matter of Gauss and what that implies. The problem with the economic problem and related problems of our national policy is that we have become a sophistical society. That is, in the post-war period, under the influence of the Mont Pelerin Society, for example, the influence of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, and similar kinds of corruption, we went from a society which was, would used to argue on the basis of the truthfulness of things, even though many people lied a lot of the time, but at least there was the idea that there was some truth someplace, and that you could search for it and argue about it. In the post-war period, that ended. The right wing, the so-called McCarthyite turn, got rid of that. People no longer were interested in the truth. They were interested in avoiding trouble, avoiding persecution, avoiding being called a communist or something. So in that period, you had a conditioning process led by the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which brainwashed the parents, your parents, or your parent, the generation of your parents, during the 1950s and beyond. So that people who were part of the 68er generation, responding to the Vietnam War, were actually products of education done, especially during the 1950s, when many of them moved out to suburbia, and they lied like hell in order to try to protect themselves against McCarthyism and things like that. And they no longer believed in telling the truth. They believed in telling a story which was imagined was to their advantage or not to their disadvantage. What the truth was not something you debated. What you concentrated on was arguing for your self-image as the kind of guy who should not be in trouble and the kind of guy who should get all kinds of riches and opportunities laid out before him. So we're a corrupt society. We no longer believe in principle. You find the two things, and for example, in science education. Science education as such has collapsed in the United States over the past quarter century. We no longer are really producing scientists. We produce people who are called scientists with some mathematical training of sorts, but they're not really scientists. They don't believe in physical principles. They don't believe in experimental method to define physical principles. And therefore, in trying to get the present new generation of young adults, your generation, into shape to take over the country, but in the meantime to become a key constituency in reorganizing the population around a rebuilding of the country, the youth need a clear sense of what a universal principle is. What is true? What is truth? Because the older generation no longer believes in truth. They believe in saying what is to your advantage. They are sophists, just like the sophists of ancient Greece who went into the Peloponnesian War under the influence of sophistry. And, of course, the Vietnam War, the present Iraq War, and so forth, are examples of the same kind of phenomenon whereby the culture of ancient Greece destroyed itself through things like the Peloponnesian War. They destroyed themselves because of the spread of sophistry replacing the commitment to truth, which is what the big issue was, of course, of Socrates and of Plato against the sophists. So in a sophist situation, and we know from the history of European civilization in particular, that whenever a part of European civilization, of all of it, goes into a period of sophistry, as now, that culture has lost the ability to survive, to outlive and recover from troubles like those which are hitting us now. And therefore, the important thing here is to take a core within the young adult generation, that is 18 to 25 range, and to build in them a sense for them of what the meaning of truth is, what the meaning of a principle is. So we start with Gauss, and the Gauss fight against a form of sophistry, which was typified by this case of D'Alembert, Euler, and Lagrange, and others. We take that. We go through other kinds of things, which are classical studies, dated and largely from the time of the Pythagoreans on, which are proven methods of identifying, in respect to physical science, certain basic things which represent truth. Your independent ability to discover the truth, not just having to look it up in a book someplace, but actually to discover it for yourself, to know what the truth is, and to be able to share discussion of the truth as the truth among yourself. That doesn't mean you have the final answer. That means you know what it is to be truthful, what it is to follow a method of work, of thinking and argument, which is actually the kind of argument and work you need to do to discover what the truth might be. It may not be perfect knowledge of the truth. It certainly is not going to be complete knowledge. But it is truthful. And if we, as long as we can organize society around truthfulness of that type, we have a chance. Now, well, in the course of a general education of a movement which is capable of dealing with this crisis of truthfulness, we start with things like Gauss, because Gauss's 1799 paper is the most accessible and direct and efficient way of raising the relevant questions. We then go backwards and forwards in history, back to ancient Greece, to the Pythagoreans, and into modern other work, and we get a general sense of a few good examples of what scientific truth is, what scientific principles are. Now, we use then the same method to apply to a different kind of thing, to social relations. And we have used, of course, the Bach, Jesu meine Freude, which is a very sophisticated treatment by Bach of what had been originally a simple Lutheran hymn, which is very sophisticated from the standpoint of its content and also its composition, which gives people in a social process, and a choral singing is a social process. When it's done in a professional way or in a professional direction, as bel canto discipline, it is a way of seeing how you can function together in a society. How a result which is the product of an interaction among people, not just of parallel action by them. So what we're doing, essentially, with the youth movement is to focus on two areas, on fundamental ideas of principle as we know them in science, pivoted on this Gauss issue, and also taking the Bach, Jesu, meine Freude as a kind of organized social experience which gives people the enhanced ability to have insight into the kinds of principles of classical artistic composition, poetry, music, and so forth, and politics, which are needed to deal with the social processes around which the scientific or physical activity of society can be organized. That's what we're doing. And in the particular on the West Coast, I think you're doing a particularly good job. We're having some successes in the East Coast, but the problem is the boomers are a little bit more influential over the youth in the East Coast and in Europe, and that has become a problem for us. But they are progressing nonetheless. The Boston development is useful. It has its limitations, but I've pushed it because it's important that we do it, to try to do in the East Coast what you have done, in a sense, on the West Coast. So that's where the future lies. Where the crisis is coming on, we have to understand the crisis we're living in. We have to understand that our influence upon the people around us, both of the youth generation and the older generation, is going to be crucial in getting the Democratic Party and some Republicans together to provide actions, modes of action, which will handle the problem. That is, at least give us survival and attempt and the opportunity to actually succeed down the line, not to go into a big, deep depression, a deep crisis of civilization. And youth are key to that. So this is where we stand. We are in a world where we are indeed influential as a very relatively small force, but we are extremely influential ones because there's a vacuum in which what we're doing is needed. And we're filling a vacuum with a very few people, relatively speaking, and it's a large vacuum. We are having good effects. We're having recognition in terms of gratefulness about what we're doing among leading circles in the country and internationally. We're doing our job. We're doing it well. We're not doing it well enough because the job is still bigger than we are or bigger than we and our friends are. But we're doing well. We're moving in that direction. And the key thing here is for us to accept the challenge of development, challenge of development in scientific thinking, as typified by the science program centered around the Gauss 1799 paper and what that implies. Now, the challenge of understanding social relations, how they have to be organized, is typified by the experience of training and seeing the deeper implications of Bach's Instrumenta Freude as a choral effort. These kinds of things are essential. We're doing well. There's no guarantee that we're going to win anything. There's no guarantee the nation's going to survive. There are no guarantees. Since there are no guarantees, we just have to work harder at it. And I think we're doing a fair job, but not a good enough one yet. So, that's where we stand.
Okay, we can take a few questions. So if you have a question, come up quickly. Scott, Jared, Brendan, one more. Look, Scott, come on up.
Hey, hello, Lynn. This is Scott. From Oakland, we've been working on the how Gauss determined the orbit of Ceres, and I've been looking at like Jupiter and Saturn, and I was just curious how did these guys begin to try to figure out, you know, like orbits and things like this? Because looking up at Jupiter, you can't really see it move.
Well, we look at the records as you start with, say, with Kepler, because Kepler's work on defining the orbits of the planets simply as a matter of observation is a key to answering the first part of your question, or the bottom part of your question. You're on the planet Earth, right? And the Earth is rotating, and you're observing from a point on the planet Earth, which is rotating. The Earth itself is moving through an orbit, an Earth orbit, within a solar system. Now, from this point on Earth, which is a point on the Earth's surface, in a planet that is rotating, and a planet that is orbiting, you're now looking out at some other object which is also rotating and orbiting in the solar system, such as Jupiter. And this is called normalization. In other words, you have to examine all the data to the point of trying to reconstruct an image so that you correct for the changes in the point from which you're observing, both on the rotating surface of the Earth and in the Earth's orbit, and the motion of the planet. So now you come to what's called a normalization, which gives you the effect of having looked at the motion of Jupiter as if from a fixed point within the solar system. That's what you have to thus get the data cleaned up in that way. And Kepler did a lot of that, as he, particularly on the case of the observation on Mars, which is his most famous work, where his more refined normalization of the observational data on the Mars motion was key in his approximate initial discovery of universal gravitation. Discovery of the idea of the principle of gravitation. So that's what you start with. So it really is not that complicated conceptually. It's complicated in the sense that you have to normalize your observations from a moving point, both on a rotating Earth, a moving point within an Earth which itself is in orbiting, in respect to a changing position with respect to the Sun and Jupiter, for example, or the Sun and Mars, you know, is something you have to do. And until you get that work sorted out, you don't have the data in hand to begin to ask about some of the anomalies in the motion which will lead you to discovery of the scientific principles involved in the eccentricity, apparently, of these motions. So that's the problem. It does take a lot of work. And it does take a lot of experience in handling this kind of data to get it sorted out cleanly so it does mean something and you can trust it for as normalized to the point of being able to take on something, as, for example, Gauss did in this question of Ceres. I mean, actually discovering the orbit of Ceres from three key points of observation, and to infer from that through a background of normalization, what the orbit was, which was common to these three observations. That's a rather an interesting challenge, and it's worth studying for that reason, because it's the excitement of actually going through how do you discover the orbit of something from, say, three observations of that something you are studying. And that was what Gauss did. It's the kind of exercise in itself, which is not simply passing the course, it's actually training yourself as to how to think better about these kinds of challenges. But there is a lot of work involved.
Hi, Lynn. This is Jared. The question I had was, vaguely before you spoke about how the Earth and the other planets were formed off of the Sun, and when I was reading through Vernadsky, we were talking about, Vernadsky was saying that instinctually they knew that the planets were, that the Earth was like the child, like were the children of the Sun, but they hadn't proved it scientifically. So I was wondering how you actually prove scientifically that we came from the Sun.
Well, what happened is this concept in that way, many people had this idea. And there was much work in that direction, saying that somehow the plasma formed out of this fast-spinning sun. Remember, the sun at an earlier phase was rotating much more rapidly and was a larger sun than it is today. So in its rotation, it spun off material, plasma material, which formed most, at least, of the planetary system out of this material. There may have been some wanderers who wandered in to the system, and their material came with them. But essentially, the main thing we're looking at is the actual formation of planetary orbits and planets and moons from material which originally came from the sun. Now, what was known is, since Kepler, and Kepler's study of this, that the fast-spinning sun, the young fast-spinning sun, was sitting there kind of alone in its neck of the universe, in its neck of the stellar constellations. But in being fast-spinning, and the way that Kepler calculated, it would cast off material. And this material would then be available, and Kepler's argument was, of course, that this material, which is spun off from the sun as a plasma around it, was actually distilled, sort of fractionally distilled, into predetermined available orbits, which are the orbits which Kepler defines in his thing on the Weltharmonik, the world harmonies. That much was known. Then I come along in the 1970s and early 1980s. I say, wait a minute, we've got a problem here. The periodic table, which could be generated by this kind of action by the sun in the plasma area around it, would not account for the 92 elements we attributed to the solar system during my university days, before we got into the so-called higher elements. Therefore, how did we get this periodic table? of the solar system of the planets. Well, I said, wait a minute, there's one way it could be done. And on this I consulted with our dear friend, Professor Robert Mohn. And we had some discussion about this. We agreed that if we had a polarized fusion occurring in the orbit around the sun, immediately around the orbit around the sun, on the plasma, then the radiation from the sun hitting this kind of disk of plasma would generate fusion, a higher degree of fusion, giving us the heavier planets as a possibility. So therefore, we gave this picture of, which is essentially a Kepler-Riemann picture of the history, the biological history, so to speak, of the solar system, starting from a fast-spinning Keplerian young sun, shedding its material into a plasma, a disk around the sun, a disk along the planar level of the planets, and actually having a high enough intensity of fusion, of thermonuclear fusion, to generate the full periodic table of the observed solar system. And that's what we did. And that's where the evidence stands today. We haven't had much improvement on that. What Vanatsky had much to say, but I think I don't know much of Vanatsky saying much on this subject, even though his work does bear on it. Because his approach is that. His approach is that of a developmental approach, that there are three developmental principles, or sets of principles in the solar system. One, the abiotic material, processes which experimentally are defined as abiotic, sufficiently defined as abiotic. Then we have systems which cannot be defined sufficiently as abiotic. And these are living processes with their own characteristics. So the principle of life is distinct from that of non-life. Then we have a third one, which is the accumulation of material, which is generated on the planet by human activity only. That is human creative activity, which is not otherwise generated or could be generated by living processes. So that becomes the noosphere, that the domination of the system by man, the mind of man discoveries the noosphere. That's where Vanatsky's thinking goes. Now remember, Vanatsky was not only, shall we say, an author of geobiochemistry from the School of Mendeleev and so on. He was also about everything. He was a polymath, that he had many fields of science, including biology, including this sort of thing. And he was a rare genius. So you have to be very careful about saying he only understood this or only understood that. What you have available is what you know that he did. And keep your mind open, because you may find another paper by him someplace that shows you that he knew something else in addition to what you think he already knew. You thought he already knew.
Hello, Lynn. This is Brendan from Los Angeles. I think a lot of people have been asked, at least there's been discussion around exactly what you mean by a process sheet, because at first glance, it seems that it's just a hierarchy, a simple or an array of processes that seem to be in a hierarchy. But if you look at some of this work that the Curvature Group's been doing on the REA, and just in general work on the economics, that there are certain processes that are obviously dependent. Like you look at the General Motors case, for example, that these factories and these production facilities are obviously dependent on other processes outside of the plant itself. But seemingly within there are certain processes which produce a qualitatively higher productive effect. And it's not necessarily the processes which give that factory the ability to exist, but the ability to utilize the technology in that productive facility. So I was wondering if you could clarify some of this, exactly what you're looking at, and then also relative to infrastructure development.
Oh, you find it first in the term process sheet. If you look up books and so forth that from library shelves from, say, the 1950s or earlier, or even somewhat later, 1950s, 1960s, you will find that under the title of industrial engineering, you will find the this item comes up and is explained in one level as a common practice. That is, a plant manager or the production manager of a corporation is setting out to produce a new product, or say a new product line, and a new product within a new product line. What do you start with? Well, first of all, you have to have the conception of what you're going to do. And if you know everything you're going to use in terms of principles and materials along the way, you have to sort this out, because you will start at point A, where you begin the process of developing the product that you're finally going to deliver. And you find that each step of this process requires a certain lapse of time, and that certain aspects of the total process, the total requirements, will come into place in that process, that connection, at certain points. So this, the tracing of these steps, all these materials required, all these actions required, from the time that you start the idea of producing a product until you deliver the first item as a finished product, defines a process sheet. That's all there is to it. I mean, from the standpoint of industrial engineering, and in the old days, every industrial engineer should understand that as part of their qualification for an M something or other in a master's degree in industrial engineering or something like that. That's not the complicated part. The fun part comes in the implications of that, when you get into the implications of technological progress. Now, that's where my particular emphasis lies. The process sheet, when I talk about a process sheet, anyone from competent experience in management of industrial management from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and even earlier, understood this. That's not a problem. The problem comes in understanding how technology works in this process, where changes in technology are in progress. See, normally the first step of a process sheet is you start from known things that you can buy or you can build or make. That's what the industrial engineering department will do together with the management and so forth in defining a product. I say, we can get this material, we can get that, we can get this, all known things. But we will use these and bring them in at certain points in the stage of the steps of this process leading to the delivery of the first product of the type we're now going to be producing, developing and producing. The interesting thing comes when you say, well, what about the intervention in this process? If the cycle is going to take 3 years from the time you start to think of producing something until the time you actually deliver the first item of this thing, then what if something change in technology occurs during that three-year interval at various points? What if it could occur during that period? What if you decide to develop a new technology and put that in the point? So then it gets much more interesting, is which way I come into the picture, as I've described this summarily in process. That's all that's involved here. Now, the point is this. The basic starting point, if we want to do a process sheet of all production rather than just one particular product, where do you start? Well, you start with the total environment. You start with an effect with basic economic infrastructure. For example, the level of quality of power production available is a limitation. The water management is a limitation. The degree to which you manage the environment in order to raise the environmental level of living processes to a higher level. For example, generally trees will, comparable to grasses, trees will tend to absorb up to 10% of the solar radiation and convert it into biological material, whereas grasses may be 1% to 2%, that sort of thing, plus or minus. But that's the idea of the thing. So therefore, what you're trying to do, in Vernadsky's term, he's trying to build up the biosphere. First of all, you're trying to organize the abiotic dimension. Well, you're getting ore, for example. You got ore from certain sources. Can you find some better way to develop the concentration of these ores, their availability or substitutions and so forth, so you have better abiotic materials available in general as part of the environment? Do you have a better biological environment? Do you have the right trees, enough of them in the right places, the right grasses, all these kinds of things that go into the biological environment of production? Do you have the right power systems or the right intensity of power development? For example, if you want a modern economy, you now have to have a nuclear energy economy and a fusion economy coming after that soon. And down the line, perhaps a century or so, we go into a matter-antimatter reaction basis of power sources for driving the economy. So these kinds of things are the environment, the basic economic infrastructure in which we function. In this, then, you have the major capital goods of production. Some of these have a life expectancy of a quarter century. That is, the machinery or similar kinds of things which are part of the production process, you expect them to last you for about a quarter of a century, or 10 years or 15 years, whatever. So now, the trick is this. If you want to have the best result in an economy, from the standpoint of the process sheet, you go to the beginning part of the process sheet cycle in the economy as a whole. Not just a product, not just a branch of industry, but the economy as a whole. If you can bring in advances in technology at the level where you're making investments in long-term capital improvements, whether in the abiotic domain, in the biosphere domain, or in the noosphere domain generally, then you will have a product whose improvement in technology will be beneficial all through the cycle of life of that particular investment, say 25 years. So therefore, rather than concentrating on the lower end, that is the things which are you're producing in the short term, which have a life of less than a year, if you have neglected the things which have a 25-year life, you're going to have a much lower rate of improvement in productivity than if you can concentrate changes in technology at the high end, that is, at the beginning of the process. And that's what I am emphasizing, that if you take the machine tool sector, as represented by General Motors, Ford, and so forth, that sector of their production capacity, which can produce all kinds of things, not just automobiles. It can produce nuclear power stations or components of it. It can produce components of water management systems and all kinds of things, as well as railway systems and their locomotives and whatnot. So therefore, if you concentrate in this area and build up your machine tool sector that does this, you're going to have the greatest rate of improvement in productivity and quality of goods in the economy. That is the greatest rate of growth of wealth. Whereas if you were to concentrate only on the near end, that is the last 6 months or a year or so, in things that involve that kind of cycle, you're going to have a much less improvement in the total economy than you will if you concentrate for priority on the machine tool sector as such. So that's what we're talking about. If I take the machine tool sector and things like it, and if I concentrate effort there on producing families of products, of kinds of products, which have a long-term life generally, or the process of making them has a long-term life, if in this area of capital goods I have a high rate of improvement of technology, I'm going to have the highest possible relative rate of gain in productivity in the economy as a whole. And that's what the machine tool sector means to me. And I generalize the machine tool sector, not merely what is in General Motors and Ford, for example, for automobile production, but more generally. And that's what the whole thing is about.
Lynn, can you take one more?
Aye, sure.
Okay.
Hello, Lynn. This is Dustin from Los Angeles. I had a two-part question about Martin Luther.
Yeah?
I've been told that he was influenced by the Venetians. I was wondering where I could find evidence of that. And then I was wondering, on the statement that Luther made of reason being the enemy of faith, I was under the understanding that he was referring to a particular type of reasoning. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Now, it's a complicated mess because, now, the question about Luther on Venice is very clear. The Venetians created Luther. it was part of a process at the time that you had a religious warfare was organized by Venice from about the time of the siege of Constantinople, where the Venetians were key factors in the Ottoman occupation of Constantinople. And the Venetians did this to attempt to abort and destroy the 15th century Renaissance, the Golden Renaissance. So from that point on, from the fall of Constantinople to modern times, there's been a bifurcation of European civilization's development between two tendencies. One, the tradition of the modern nation-state as founded essentially during and as a result of the Renaissance, the mid-15th century Renaissance, the so-called Golden Renaissance, and the counter-operation from the Venetian financier oligarchy, which was trying to, in a sense, destroy this idea of the modern nation-state and what that implied. So that's been the policy. Now, the first weapon they used was religious warfare. For example, they used the conquest of Constantinople by the Ottomans as a form of religious warfare. So war against Christian and Turk. This was the kind of thing that Samuel P. Huntington is pushing today, right? It was used to try to destroy the attempt to get a ecumenical unity of civilization. The ecumenical unity which was described by Nicholas Fakuzy in his paper, De Pace Fide, a paper which was emphasized by the now present Cardinal Benedict XVI of Cusa's. Then the other thing was to create religious warfare within Christianity. Now, the first step of that was the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492 by Torquemada, which is the precedent for what Hitler did later down the line against the Jews in Central Europe. This 1492 expulsion of the Jews set into motion religious warfare throughout Europe. And what you had, what we call Protestant sects, were all formed as out of the Catholic Church by forces within the Catholic Church which were complicit in this effort to organize religious warfare. For example, you have the case in England, the case of Henry VIII. Now, Henry VIII was probably insane. His father, Henry VII, otherwise known as Richard, was one of the founders of the modern nation-state. He was at the court of Louis Onze, who founded the first modern nation-state, Louis Onze of France. And he carried the lessons of his experience of Louis' founding of the first modern nation-state in France into the overthrow of Richard III and establishing the second modern nation-state in England of Henry VII. This was the English culture of Sir Thomas More, for example. Now, in comes a fellow called Zorzi, Francesco Zorzi, who was the chief of the intelligence service of Venice. Now, this fellow goes to England to become the marriage counselor to Henry VIII. And the result of this Venetian operation, which initially was considered an attack on Martin Luther, you had the English split from the Catholic Church generally, and the promotion of religious wars among various Protestant and Catholic groups, Spain, France, England, and so forth and so on, into Germany in the case of the Thirty Years' War. Now, in the case of Luther, Luther's work, both on the Luther's Bible, especially on the Old Testament, was done entirely by Venetians for him. And so this is not a question of some mystery. This is just plain, clear documentation of the time. And it used a lot of issues. There were, for example, German issues. There were the issues about the German state, this is going way back, the history of Charlemagne, who was the founder of the so-called Germanic idea of the nation state, which went with other states down through Frederick II of Italy, you know, which continued through into Spain, into the family of Isabella, who was a part, an offshoot of this German tendency. So you had issues, German issues as such, which were kind of national issues, were played upon against Rome. And the issue about issues of collection of dues and so forth, this sort of thing, was all part of it. But Venice intervened heavily into Germany and adopted Martin Luther as a project which they would support. At the same time, they were supporting the other side, Charles V of Habsburg. So this was a divide-and-conquer operation. Now, this underwent various evolutions. The most important one came in the 17th century, at the end of the close of the Thirty Years' War, at which the Peace of Religions organized at Utrecht and so forth, and ending the Thirty Years' War, religious war, actually established a new order in Europe. At a later point, there were attempts to revive a Protestant-Catholic, that is, Lutheran-Catholic controversy in Germany, which was essentially neutralized largely by Bismarck under the influence of the U.S. Civil War, the outcome of the Civil War, that Bismarck in Germany instituted changes in law based on study of the U.S. economy's successes up through 1876. And this occurred in 1877, and it occurred directly under the influence of the American success. So Bismarck adopted an American model for the development of an agro-industrial economy. And he did that in 1877. He also instituted the public welfare system of Germany, which is rather famous, which is being destroyed now under the Hartz-IV arrangement. This kind of thing. So there was a peace between Catholic and Protestant in Germany. And in this context, there were large degrees of evolution. For example, the best case of this is Bach's work, Jesu meine Freude, one of the reasons we've emphasizes its significance, is first of all, it started as the simple Lutheran hymn. But the part we have our youth sing is actually a development by Bach himself. What Bach did was to bring in the works of the Apostle Paul and play them as a counterpoint, idea counterpoint, to what had been the original Lutheran hymn. So what you get with the Bach Jesu meine Freude is the transformation of a simple Lutheran hymn into a motet, which is a much higher order, which then becomes an integral part of the Protestant musical culture of Germany and spills over from the Protestant into the Catholic in various ways, various degrees of influence, out of Leipzig. So that a simple explanation of any of these phenomena, a mechanical, categorical explanation of what all these religious differences were, is generally breaks down to nonsense. If you go through the history, there are clear indications in the history of how things worked out. But it's not a simple conspiratorial this or that. It's a much more complex process in which history is constantly intervening to change the significance, the implications of development. And this is true of Lutheranism.
All right, Lynn, since we know you're writing a new paper for us, we'll give you the time to do that. So thank you very much for being with us this morning.
Thank you. Thank you.